¿Cómo están, hermanos y hermanas? My name is Juan López, and this is Spanglish Seminary. My brother Rogelio will be back with us next week. And our podcast is centered on la experiencia latina in the church, sobre the space between Spanish and English, Catholics and Aleluyas, Latin America, y el Norte. And I'm really excited about this week. We talk with our friend Jeremy Hunt, who recently began working towards a PhD in theology with a concentration in theology and culture. And we talked with him about the worship music industry and how you two directly influenced or pretty much created the industry, we can say. We also talk about sci-fi and horror movies and how they can tell the story of how we see our own humanity, which is a really interesting topic. I hope you guys enjoy that part. We also discussed the band he's a part of named Koheleth, and that's spelled Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H. And it's a word. I don't want to butcher it. I'll let him explain it, but it's in the Bible from the book of Ecclesiastes. And we also discussed the process of creating the album along with his other bandmates. You can find more about Koheleth at kohelethnoise.com, and I'll spell that out. It's Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H, and then the word noise, N-O-I-S-E.com. Muchas gracias for all the support. And, you know, I've just been following up with a lot of you guys and some hermanas as well who've been really supportive on Twitter and Facebook. So we really appreciate it. Muchas gracias for that. And you can follow us, for those who don't follow us yet, you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Spanglish Seminary. And on Twitter, it's a little different. It's Spanglish_SEM. So thank you again for all the support, and we hope you enjoy this week's episode. Gracias.
Can you guys hear me? Okay. Do I need to adjust the volume or anything?
No, we're good.
Perfect. Okay.
Sounds great.
How are you? I have a fan on above my head. Can you guys,
No.
Are you picking any of that up?
Not at all.
Okay, perfect. Sweet.
Dude.
What's up?
Nothing. Just trying to figure out how to incorporate more Spanglish into this podcast. Trying to be real.
I'll follow. Since I don't speak any Spanish, I'll follow your lead. You guys.
I know.
You guys can
just be like, ¿cómo estás? Or I don't know. It's just no. I don't want to be gimmicky either. But it is what it is. So thank you. I guess that's where we start.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
I think this is going to be easier than the other ones. You're going to have to edit the first 5 minutes or whatever, the first minute. let's start here. This is a question that I've been asking everybody. How did you start in your academic theological journey? And I always make the same mistake. Okay, hold on. Stop.
That's fine.
So how did you start in your academic theological journey?
Probably started, well, it started in earnest about 3.5 years ago. So we were still living in Charlotte at the time, and I was working for a healthcare organization, and it was a good job in terms of the pay, but it was really, really stressful, and managing social media for them basically round the clock by myself. And been there for a couple of years, and it got to the point where I was just like, I can't keep doing this. I can't maintain this pace and also have time for my family and be there for them and my community the way I wanted to be. So I clearly remember April and I were standing in our kitchen one afternoon, one evening, and she just looked at me like out of the blue, and she's like, I think you need to seriously consider going back to school and like look into teaching. So that's really where it started jumping off, was just looking at seminary. I graduated from college in 2003, so I'd been out of school for a long time, and it was the sort of thing where almost jokingly I had said if I were ever going to go back to school for any reason, it would be seminary. And I don't know why even back then I said that. Yeah, so that's when we started looking around, and at that point, really, Fuller was the main choice, where I just finished up my master's because of their arts program, because of the Brehm Center, and just the focus that they had on the arts that, to the best of my knowledge, nobody really else at the time had, at least in a formalized way. So,
you know, it's interesting that the way me and you met was that I had to enroll in a Pentecostal seminary in Cleveland, Tennessee, because so I went south online, south online, obviously, and you came over here, and you know, obviously, our pastor now, with Jeremy and I both are at Parish Long Beach and helping start that church, and so it's just interesting our stories that you had to, you know, this is how disconnected I was. I had no idea Fuller even existed.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, kind of stumbled into seminary and ended up at, you know, Pentecostal Theological Seminary in Cleveland, Tennessee.
And, yeah, totally.
And so it's just interesting, you know, seeing how that intersects. And so tell me about the program. Talk about the program and what you're studying there and what your focus is.
Okay. Yeah, so I just finished up my master's, and I did that with their – Fuller has three schools, three different schools within the school. So there's a school of theology, school of psychology, and then school of intercultural studies. I think that's the right term. And so my degree was in – it was a Master of Arts in Theology with a focus on – theology and the arts, and specifically I was working on music. Like I said, they have a center within Fuller called the Brehm Center, and it's completely focused on the intersection of theology and culture, theology and art. So they have like a Brehm Center filmmakers group. One of the professors there is dedicated to a new initiative for reviving, I think that's the right term, reviving and or bringing a new focus to like classical sacred music within the church, like I believe hymns and even older sort of songs and forms of worship through music. And so now I've had the summer off and I'm getting ready to start the PhD program at Fuller, which is scary and nerve-wracking and exciting. But I'll be continuing the focus on music and theology. As a musician, that's where my passion lies, and I think there's a lot of good work, hopefully, to be done still in those fields and in those places of intersection. And hopefully I can just do a small part to contribute to that.
I guess this would be the next good question to segue into that. I mean, for at least in the United States, and I mean, you know, without mentioning names, you know, we know worldwide popular, you know, worship bands and how that kind of is affecting a lot of smaller churches and that is seen as the standard of what worship in church should look like.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to say to that as far as what you're studying? And go, you know, we can make this a 2-part podcast if you want to, and we'll just be like, start here, you know?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I'll say this. I'm trying to think about the best way to answer that. That's a good question. In terms of my particular area of study, I'm actually not focusing, at least for now, and I mean, obviously anything can change over the next few years as I work through the PhD program and start working on a dissertation, but my initial focus is actually not church-focused, if only because, again, as a musician, worship music tends to be fairly narrowly focused. At least in my experience, this tends to be very narrowly focused in terms of musical styles. And so what I'm trying to do is sort of broaden it to say what's being done in other genres of music. Specifically for me, the stuff I'm passionate about would be music like punk, hardcore, noise rock, metal, stuff that tends to exist more on the fringes, at least within certain communities. And I'm trying to approach it from the standpoint of saying, I know there's a lot of really interesting spiritual exploration happening in these genres, but I don't think that the church at large is aware of that. And so what I'm hoping to do is sort of bring those two groups eventually into conversation with one another. Now, whether or not that would spill over into the actual music portion of the worship experience in churches, I kind of doubt it, just because I don't think most people would find those sorts of things conducive. And they probably wouldn't be conducive necessarily to worship, but I think, I don't know, it's weird. I find certain artists in those genres to be worshipful in their own ways. But again, just within the framework of the way church is done, at least in America and at least in my, you know, narrow experience, they probably wouldn't be too, the style wouldn't be super welcome on a, like a Sunday morning. In terms of the other part of the question that you were asking, if I remember correctly, you know, I think my biggest struggle, because I've spent a decent amount of time in worship bands, volunteering and serving through worship bands, and there's a portion of it that I absolutely love, and that is the camaraderie and sort of the teamwork and the sense of community that you get through that. Like, that's a beautiful, beautiful thing, and I have always loved that. My struggle has always been, again, it tends to be sort of narrowly focused in terms of musical style. And that could be because, you know, the churches I've served in have been, you know, sort of predominantly just like mainline Protestant or even Pentecostal churches, mostly white in the South. So I want to give that caveat that could be a piece of the puzzle there. But, you know, the joke I make with my friends, and I'm sure there will be people that love me for saying this, is that, U2 is the worst thing to ever happen to worship music. I have friends who adore U2 and more power to them, but I do think, in all seriousness, I do think that there's a strain of worship music, for whatever reason, that latched onto that sort of like big, almost like rock sound. And for whatever reason, it's just become embraced. And I feel like it's everywhere. It's just that's, you know, all that you hear when you hear, you know, a new worship album or a new worship song, is that it's just continuing to sort of emulate that vibe. And, I'd like to see the church do something different, you know? So, sorry, that may be a really long-winded answer.
That's great. That's a really good answer. You know, it's interesting because for me personally, what ended up happening, as far as in, like, the Latino Pentecostal context, the worship portion of the service was just as important as the sermon. And... Mm-hmm. You know, it all led towards the end of... It has its own liturgy, right? Like, there's the worship, there's the sermon, and then there's the response of the altar call. And it's liturgical. And so you have... over time, you start to see it's the same people crying at the same time through the same song. And this isn't knocking it. I mean, this is just what happens, right? And... the same people coming to the altar to be prayed for at the same time. And you start to see that, what are we doing here, right? And so for me, what ended up happening was my wife and I experienced the loss of a child. And here we are grieving and going into every Sunday to a service that you're always hearing songs of victory. You're always hearing songs of, if you're not experiencing the joy of the Lord, maybe there's something wrong with you. And hearing that every Sunday when you're lamenting. So for me, that kind of opened a big, not to use a cliche, that it wasn't the straw that broke the camel's back, but it did cause a big rift and opened, you know, that I wanted to lament. I wanted songs of lament. I didn't feel like I was in victory. I wasn't mm-hmm. in victory, you know? And
amen.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And so it's interesting to see that the as far as in our context, and, you know, we're talking about, you know, Pentecostal churches or just Protestant churches, we don't right. have enough songs of lament. I don't know about mm-hmm. other places in the world, but hearing from what you're telling me about the punk rock scene, and I mean, or any other, you know, those fringe scenes,
mm-hmm.
these are young men and women and people that create mm-hmm. songs of lament, and you right. read that, and when you start to read the Psalms, you see that there is this angst, this you know, to mm-hmm. quote the latest Kendrick Lamar song, you know, why God do I have to suffer? Like, you don't hear that.
Yeah.
You don't hear that being sung. Why do I have to suffer, God?
No. Yeah, and to be fair, after I just threw them under the bus, there are U2 has lament songs. You know, like one of my favorite albums from them is the Pop record. I think Pop is a brilliant record. I remember reading an article at one point talking about how the author viewed Pop as sort of like their Job at that point in their career. Like, it was an album of a lot of deep sorrow. They have that song Wake Up Dead Man, where they're basically like calling on Jesus to witness the suffering of the world and asking that question, where are you? So I think it's interesting. I completely agree with you. I think it's interesting that we, for whatever reason, have adopted the more triumphant, victorious side of these things, and yet have, even from the artists that have been emulated, who have made room and space for lament, we haven't brought that in as well.
Well, U2 definitely grew up and evolved as a band, but the worship bands that they inspired, you know, haven't. Maybe it's the overrealized eschatology where we think, you know, everybody's waiting for things to get better and, you know, the victory and, you know, healing and all those right. things that, regarding eschatology and regarding, you know, the end and even prosperity yeah. gospel, like it, I guess that does affect the content of what we're singing about. So,
yeah. Well, and I also think it goes to like the tendency that I see within a lot of like Christian storytelling in general. So whether it's storytelling within music or Christian movies or whatever the case may be, is that there's a real tendency to want to jump, like you said, to the victory at the end. Like there's a real tendency to want to jump, even if there's you know, some tension or some conflict, there's always a desire to resolve, you know, to resolve to a place of healing, to resolve to a place of salvation, to resolve to a place of reconciliation. And that's all good and well, but I think if that's all that your art is doing within a certain genre or within a certain community, it's very short-sighted because it leaves no space for all the other times and all the other experiences that we all go through where things are unresolved and things are left wounded and things are left unhealed. And just the open-endedness of the brokenness of life, where some of these things may not get resolved until, you know, the other side of eternity, if you want to put it that way. I mean, there are certain things that I think we all face, where, you know, pray as hard as we might, trust as hard as we might, walk as faithfully as we will, certain things won't necessarily be healed in our lifetimes, perhaps. So I think that tendency to always, you know, want to jump to that conclusion, like you said, I think leads to a lot of emptiness within the art form itself.
And well, let's talk about let's change over to movies.
Okay.
That's the interesting. I mean, as far as art, we were it was interesting because we recently saw. We're kind of dating the podcast here, right? But we saw the movie Alien a few weeks ago, and
yeah.
Alien, was it Alien Covenant?
Yeah, Alien Covenant.
And so it's just even interesting and what it was talking about, you know, creation and death and fear of death. And there's a lot to take in there. I think even with science fiction, like, what would you say about science fiction and you know, the way we imagine aliens and the way we imagine other lives? What does that say about how humans view their place in the world? Their place in creation.
Yeah. Man, you're asking really, really simple, easy to answer questions. No, this is great. I love it. Well, I mean, you know, for me, you know, not to make it all about me, but just in terms of like the lens that I've always seen sci-fi through, like my favorite sci-fi tends to reframe questions and debates and struggles that we're having in new sort of a new clothing and a new light, so that you can grapple with it in a way that feels fresh and that feels different. And sometimes it helps to be able to look at things through different lenses to be able to come to, you know, new conclusions or to reach new ideas. So that's one of my favorite things just about the genre in general, in terms of like humanity and where we see our place in it. I mean, I think that's what sci-fi does so well, is it sort of takes us out of our normal day-to-day context and then plops us in a new scenario and say, okay, what do we think about the topics of creation, our relationship to a creator, if one exists, our relationship to the things that we create, which is, I think, you know, one of the things that we were talking about at the end of Alien Covenant, is just seeing this sort of upending of, you know, David being created by a very powerful / wise human being who then goes to annihilate and or experiment with humanity itself. So just the idea of the created flipping the tables on the creator. I mean, that's a fascinating topic in and of itself. And I think we touched on it a little bit I'm trying to think back to that conversation, but I think one of the other topics that came up was the new Blade Runner movie, and just how, obviously that's not out yet, but you know, one of my favorite things about the original was it just asked those questions about what does it mean to be human? In a movie where you have all of the humans basically hunting down their own created representations in the replicants and the androids, and exterminating them essentially, you know, what does it mean to be human in light of that sort of inhumanity?
You know, as a Pentecostal, right? You're told,
right?
You do not watch The Exorcist.
Right.
You do not watch scary movies.
Sure.
Because you will get demon possessed.
Right.
So let's talk about the horror genre, and what would you have to say to that as far as, you know, how that can be connected to theology?
Sure.
And what it tells us within that genre.
Yeah. Well, first thing I'd say, and I would say this about any art form, is that I think a lot of it comes down to, I don't know if personal boundaries is the right word. But like, I'd never say to somebody like, you have to watch horror film in order to be able to, like people just have different inclinations and people have different thresholds. So, I mean, for me, that's point number one. Like, I love horror films because of what I get out of them, but I don't expect everybody to get the same thing. I mean, similar to like heavy metal or punk, like I like music with screamy vocals and crazy distorted guitars. That's not going to speak to everybody. but with that being said, you know, years ago I had the awesome opportunity to do, I think it was just an email interview, but I wrote a couple of profiles for a book that a Relevant magazine put out. And one of the people that I got a chance to interview was Scott Derrickson, who directed The Exorcism of Emily Rose and Sinister, just, you know, did Doctor Strange from, what was that, last year, the year before? And so at the point when I interviewed him, he was known primarily for horror stuff. And I'll never forget one of the things that he told me as a believer, kind of some of the ways, and his philosophy and his attitude may have changed since then. So, you know, I don't want to put, I want to represent what he said then. I don't know if he's changed his thoughts now. But at the time, he said one of the things that he loved about the horror genre was that it was one of the few places still in storytelling where it was acceptable to have good versus evil, where it was acceptable sort of in a postmodern world, you can set up a story where there's definitive good and there's definitive evil and people go with it rather than having to have like shades of gray. And not that there can't be nuance in horror films, but that's a perspective that's always stuck with me since he and I, you know, did that interview. It's just like, wow, I'd never really thought about it that way. Like, yeah, it's okay to just say outright, like, this is the evil that we're fighting against in the horror movie, and to have something like that sort of tangibly, tangibly crystallized, if you will, in either a character or an entity that you're fighting against. Beyond that, I think it's also interesting, and I haven't done like a in-depth study of this, but I also think that there's probably something to be said for the idea that that horror films, or maybe the best of the genre in any given year, any given decade, I think also can be a point of reflection on the fears of a community or of a society, of a culture at the time. So I think that can actually be fairly interesting, or could be interesting to look at, to see what people are, you know, wrestling with, what people are dealing with at a particular point in time. What are the fears that are trying to be sort of addressed and worked through by telling these sorts of stories? So in the case of Get Out, it's not even subtext. I mean, it's the text of the movie are racial tensions and racial fears, you know, and the powerful thing about it is that it's told from a Black man's perspective. You know, Jordan Peele wrote it, directed it. It's a potent piece of filmmaking, I think, on that merit alone, beyond just the artistic value of it, which I think is fantastic. Like I said, I haven't done like an in-depth study, but I wonder if, you know, you were to go back a few years and look at like horror films after 9/11, you know, what sorts of fears might be expressed in some of the movies that came out the years after. You know, I remember, I feel like there were a lot of articles written. It's not a horror film, but when The Dark Knight came out, I remember a lot of articles, sort of think pieces and reflections being written about how it was, you know, sort of one of the first big post 9/11 superhero movies, and just what that meant in terms of the way it represented fear and chaos with the way the Joker is presented, and, you know, Batman listening in, sort of the surveillance state of like, to what extent are we willing to go to try to make sure that everybody is safe, and is that even feasible, and, you know, those sorts of things. So
the line that always stands out for me, and I'm hoping this is from this, I know part of the trilogy, but when I think it is when they're talking about the Joker, and he says, Michael Caine tells a story about, he says that some men just want to watch the world burn.
Yeah.
And that line just stood out to me, where you do realize that, you know, that it kind of captures evil.
Yeah.
You know, and it does talk about that, right? It's where the Joker doesn't want anything.
Yeah. He just wants chaos and anarchy.
Yeah, and so it's interesting that, that can segue into a lot of different things, even in music and, you know, I guess to connect both, right, music and movies and talking about anarchy, when I think about like genres of music, and even thinking of like System of a Down, right?
Right. Yeah.
I was listening to it maybe last year. I reheard one of their old first albums, and one of the things I was thinking as I was listening to it, I was like, and this is after I became a Christian and kind of was listening to that type of music again.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking, hey. These guys, I was younger in high school when I was first listening to them, and it was just, you think rage and anger, and, that's what you bottle up or whatever. But hearing the lyrics and thinking, these guys really care.
Yeah.
This is not anarchy. This is not the Joker, right? They don't want to watch the world burn. Or even someone like
Rage Against the Machine,
right?
Yeah.
You would think, and it's like, no, they care. About the world and the injustices in the world through these songs, so there is a difference. I think sometimes it gets confused. In Spanish, and I'm going to translate it terribly, but I was reading about the Dark Night of the Soul, and that there's a difference between oscuridad and tinieblas. So I think it's like. I'm going to have to like Google Translate but it's like there's a difference between darkness and maybe night or I'm going to have to like, but there is a difference, right? There's a difference between the darkness that maybe God can bring from, for example, like Job, right? Like being inside, not Job, mm-hmm. I'm terrible seminarian, the wrong, the guy that got eaten by the whale.
Jonah.
What am I thinking? Job. You mentioned Job.
They both start with J-O.
Yeah, J. We'll go with that.
Yeah.
Where he's in a dark place.
Yeah.
A dark place provided by God.
Mm.
Right? And there's a difference between the darkness of evil.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting.
Oh, that's good, man. That's really good.
So let me look it up here, because now I'm gonna want to know.
Yeah.
Obscuridad. And Google Translate is coming through in the clutch. let's see how this. I'm doing it wrong. So this is where you need if we were a professional podcast, we would have like a team. This is where you get teams of people.
Like a researcher doing it on the fly.
In the background, right? Already, like, as he heard me saying that.
Right, he'd be looking it up. He'd be
looking it up, and so obscuridad is darkness, right? And then
okay,
tinieblas is tinieblas is translated. This is the thing about the Spanish language. So obscuridad and darkness is translated the same word as darkness.
Okay,
but tinieblas is like. A deeper darkness where there's something in that darkness, right?
Okay.
Like there's something there, and obscuridad is just like the lights turn off. It's nighttime,
Yeah, yeah.
And I might be butchering that, but there's a difference between the two. And so it just to connect both of those things, it does remind me of that
the
difference between a character like the Joker and maybe what some of these rock bands are accused of doing that, wanting anarchy or wanting to watch the world burn, when in fact I think those are great songs of lament in hearing, giving it a second hearing.
And that's still, I mean, I think the important thing too for some people that might still struggle with that of like, well, I don't know if I need to be, focusing on those things or spending much time in those things. I mean, there's that heaviness in scripture as well. I mean, one of the classes I took at Fuller, it was just like an Old Testament survey, but part of it, we had to do a study of a particular psalm, and we had like a range to look at. And the one I selected was Psalm 39, which, everybody knows Psalm 40, because, well, bringing it back to U2, because of U2's 40, I waited patiently on the Lord. He came and heard my cry, lifted me up out of the mire and the depths. It's a more uplifting psalm. Well, Psalm 39 is the one before that, and it's kind of like the night before the day. And it's a really heavy psalm of David addressing God and basically feeling like his prayers are falling on deaf ears. And the psalm culminates, with him more or less saying to God, I wish you would take your gaze away from me, if only for a time, so that I can have, you know, sort of a moment's reprieve, so that I can have a break from your gaze. And then, you know, it's a heavy psalm. And I think folks would be well served, or hopefully more fully served, I guess, by, you know, knowing that it's okay to stay in those places sometimes. I think again, kind of like what we talked about earlier, you know, there's a tendency to want to sort of like rush to a resolution, or rush to a happier ending, when, you know, there are times when, for the sake of healing, for the sake of catharsis, for the sake of just being fully human, it's okay to wrestle with those things, and it's okay to be in those spaces and not feel like you have to, you know, get through just to be, you know, a good Christian.
Definitely, yeah. I think it does. So, it does affect a lot of people in that way.
Yeah. So.
And since we're still talking about music, let's talk about your album. I mean, from what you told me is that, you know, to finish your master's, you decided to start a band and then make an album. So
that's
the joke that we had for this podcast was from the Dave Chappelle show, right, where he goes, you know, I want to be a rapper, but I need a gimmick. And he's like, I'm the black sheep, son. So he was the black sheep, right? He from the bottom down, from waist down, he had the hoofs of a black sheep, right? I guess it's a hoof.
Right.
But so he's rapping, you know, half of his body he's a black sheep, and he's a black rapper, and he's just like, I'm the black sheep, son. So it was kind of, you know, he kind of talked a lot about Little John, and I don't assume that Little John with his, you know,
yeah,
and that was it. That was Little John, you know, shouting in every song, and it was, you know, top 100, top 10 album, you know, the summer or whatever. And kind of like, this is the longest segue ever, but kind of like DJ Khaled right now. And I don't assume you know who DJ Khaled
is. Oh my gosh,
DJ Khaled. There's this meme that I saw, and he says, you know, his DJ Khaled leaning against the door, and he's like, "That's a great song you have there. It'd be nice if I shouted my name all through it," you know. So. You know, everybody needs a gimmick. Everybody needs it. Ours is Spanglish Seminary. And so when you decided to make, you know, your band, what is your gimmick?
Oh, man. My gimmick is making it as obscure and tough to get into as possible, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
No, so I had wanted to. I've wanted to like start a band or be in a band for a long time. Pretty much right since out of college, I've been playing music since I was a kid, and just for one reason or another, things just never really gelled, never worked out. Like I'd be in a band or I'd be in a project, and we'd do a couple of things and work on some stuff for a while, and then it would just fall apart due to life circumstances, and so. Maybe a year or probably about a year before we moved out to California, I just got to the point, because I, you know, here's the thing. I can't really sing. I play three instruments semi-decently. I don't play drums. So it was one of these things where I never saw myself as being like the main person behind a band. I just wanted to join with other people. And you know, kind of going back to what I said about playing the worship music, like one of my favorite things was always just the camaraderie of playing with other people. Like there's just a lot of joy that I get out of playing music with other people. It's just, there's nothing else like it. But I had so many sort of like failed sort of stop and starts with different projects and different, you know, just different attempts. I finally got to the point where I was like, if anything that I try to create musically is ever going to see the light of day, I'm going to have to run it from start to finish and get it done. Like I'm going to have to take ownership of whatever it is, for better or for worse. And I'm just going to have to force myself to do something. And so that's kind of where the project at Fuller came all these different things finally sort of coalesced and merged, where I was like, oh, I've been saying I'm going to do this. I want to do this. And now I have an academic reason to do it. And now I have a deadline to force me to do it. So, yeah, I came up with the concept of the band. The band is called Koheleth, which is Hebrew from Ecclesiastes. So, like I said, right out of the gate, making it tough to get into. It's a weird word, weird pronunciation. And then I worked with two of my good friends, my cousin, who is a visual artist and painter. I wanted to have somebody sort of like in-house in the band creating our visual presence. So I asked Caden Withy to join us in that. And then my buddy, Mike Strickler, who I've known for a long time, and we played together off and on in Charlotte. He plays drums and has done some mixing. And knowing that this is going to be a very DIY, skin of our teeth sort of thing financially, I was like, hey, will you play with me and help us mix this album? And I want you to be a part of this band. Like, there's nobody else I'd rather have on board with me playing drums. So we started that and basically just started writing and sending files and ideas back and forth to each other. We talked about the concept of the album, the themes we wanted to explore. And then just started writing. I would record stuff in my garage, send it to Mike. He'd take a listen, offer feedback or thoughts. And, he sent me some rough drum tracks, just stuff I could kind of toy around with and play with. And then by the end of it, we had about, there are 8 tracks on the album. So we had about 30 minutes of music and, put it all together and packaged it up on a CD, printed up shirts, did a goofy little minifigure toy, and put it out. So it, did it both for the presentation and my master's thesis at Fuller, but then also wanted it to be something that could live beyond that. So so that's kind of the idea behind it.
That's pretty awesome. And again, if this is a bad, I'm going to say this phrase a million times this podcast, but if this is a bad question, right? Wrong phrase.
No.
What's the genre that you would put it under, or is the goal, as you mentioned, we're joking, but there's a better word than gimmick, obviously, because this is an act of love. This
right.
is an act of love that you made. So that was not, that was Dave Chappelle.
Oh, but, no.
Yeah. And, so is it, outside of a genre, or can it be placed in there? Is that the goal that for it to be so strange or so other that, what is the reason you made it in that way?
No. I mean, for me, when we were putting it together and Mike and I were talking about the music itself, for us, we see it definitely living in sort of like the noise rock, punk, experimental sort of genres, sort of crossing over those lines. Or even, if you want to get super technical about it, garage rock. I mean, I recorded the freaking thing in my garage, so it's literally a garage rock band.
Hey, in the United States started in garages, but those are more tech companies.
Yeah. True. That's awesome. Yeah. So what I said about being obscure, I mean, it's more just the noise rock and the punk genres are where I feel at home musically. They tend to be, messy and chaotic. There tends to be, I think there's more forgiveness, I think, within those genres for sort of lo-fi recording quality, which is definitely something that we had to embrace just from a financial standpoint. The mic literally that I'm using to talk to you guys on tonight is the mic that I use to record all the guitar parts, all the bass parts, and my vocals. So I had no specialized, just one mic for all of them. So part of that was just kind of like a practical decision on our part of saying, here's what we think we can pull off and make it sound, hopefully at least decent within a particular genre. And like I said, part of it's just where we felt at home, just musically, like, hey, we can play distorted, blown out rock and roll, and it sort of fits within this genre. And we tried some experimental stuff in it throughout the album. We, um, I, I, I grabbed a lot of, I think the official name for it is like field recordings. Basically, you're just going out and capturing sounds that you encounter in the in your day-to-day life. So we tried to incorporate that in a lot of the tracks. There's like, you know, the sound of a cicada's buzzing in one of the tracks. One of the tracks has like a rainstorm that I captured in my car literally as I was driving to work. It was just like a really heavy, one of the few heavy rainstorms that we get out here in Southern California.
Event. It's always an event when it rains here. So it's, yeah, that's one of the first things. And you have to post about it on Facebook. So definitely. That's right. Awesome. That sounds so. We're going to have to like get your permission to play like a 10, 20 second clip of it in the podcast.
Oh, yeah, of course.
We'll send you the contract whatever you over so we can. I'm just kidding. It was funny because we were trying to find a like a intro song for the podcast. And we kind of started going through Google, and I had an idea for a song, right? And then we realized, oh, there's such a thing as copyright law, and, you know, you can't even use people's songs for, you know, thank God for GarageBand and you know, using being able to
Yeah, totally.
That sounds amazing, and it's just really inspiring, you know, to hear your story. This is great. What would you have to say as far as any words for the church, you know, quote unquote, in our context in the United States, whether in regards to music or movies or, you know, where you're at, what would you have to say to someone out there kind of struggling with this stuff?
Yeah, man, again, with the easy questions. No, that's beautiful. I think I would say two things. One, I would say relax. I think the church, at least in my context and in my experience, tends to get, and I will say I do think we're getting better. Because I remember days growing up, like this is stuff that's always been near and dear to my heart. I mean, as a kid, I was just always drawn to music and to TV and to film and those forms of storytelling. But I grew up in very conservative backgrounds where certain things were just completely off limits. You know, like Christians just don't see R-rated movies or don't listen to metal or rap or, you know, whatever the case, like certain things were just completely off limits. And so I have seen progress over the years where there's definitely a lot more openness and a much greater willingness to dialogue with the art forms. And I'm ecstatic about that. I'm so thankful. But I do think people continue to get a little uptight or to get nervous about certain things. And so I think my first suggestion would be take a deep breath and relax. Like, it's okay to wrestle with art forms that make you uncomfortable. And it's okay to wrestle with stories and with songs that make you uncomfortable. I think we honor the people that have created those things when we do make the decision to wrestle with them. And when we do, we honor the artists, we honor the storytellers, we honor the directors, we honor the actors and the actresses, the producers, the musicians, the poets that bring these things to life, because I think they are operating out of a place of struggle and hopefully insight as well that comes through living through that struggle, if that makes sense. So that would be the first thing. And then I think the second thing would be take time to get educated on the art forms. Like, if there's one that you're sort of drawn to but uncertain about, take the time to learn the history. And when I say get educated, I don't mean you got to go to, you know, get a degree at a seminary or, I mean, there's plenty of resources out there. I mean, heck, you could start with Wikipedia if you wanted and then go from there. I wouldn't stay on Wikipedia, but, you know, find books that have been written, find folks that have done research and that are writing about these things. you know, if there's a certain artist that intrigues you or a certain genre that you're curious about, dive into it and learn about it. You know, learn the form, learn how to read a film, learn how to read an album, learn how to engage with the art on its terms first. And then you can start bringing it into dialogue with faith questions, with questions of belief, questions about God, questions about the state of humanity, whatever the case may be. But, you know, and I got to give credit where credit's due. That's one of the things that I'm grateful for from Fuller, and particularly one of my professors there, Rob Johnston, is that's his approach to film. Criticism might not be the right word, but the dialogue between faith, theology, and film, that's something that he's written about for years, is just this sense of oftentimes Christians will approach a film with a perspective of like, okay, where am I going to find Jesus in this? Or where am I going to find the correlation with a Bible story in this? And so they're coming with preset expectations, and they're almost coming with their own boundaries and their own walls imposed before they engage with the art itself on its own level. And so one of the things that Rob always talks about is learn the art form, learn it, learn how to appreciate it, learn how to see when it's done well and when it's done poorly. And then once you start engaging with a film, listen to the film, watch the film, first to be able to appreciate it as a film itself and to be able to appreciate the story that it's telling. And then after you've done that and you spent some time with it and you've lived in it and breathed with it, then you can start, you know, put it in a dialogue with scripture, put it in a dialogue with your faith. And so I think that's an approach, that works not just with film, but also with TV, with literature, with poetry, with music. I think if the church could make strides in that area, I think we would be much better partners with society and with culture at large. And I think we'd be able to bring a lot more. I think it would enliven our own art, if you will. And I think it would allow us to engage much more honestly with what's being created, sort of within the, for lack of a better word, the entertainment sort of branches of our society. So
thank you very much for everything. And my we always like to give Roger the last word if he wants to say goodbye and good night.
No, yeah, definitely. Thank you, Jeremy, again for your time.
Yeah,
I know you're pretty busy. You have a big family, but you know what? Thank you, man. You know what? You actually touched a lot of great topics, by the way.
Oh, thanks, man. Because,
I grew up loving music. I grew up playing at a church since I was small.
Yeah.
And you were totally right about how they just have this view of we like to say alabanzas, and it's just praise songs. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's definitely times that I didn't even want to play.
Yeah.
Like there's times that I didn't even want to just, I just didn't want
to. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And there's times like that.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, this is how I think. Like, the show has to go on. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That's just me, though. Like, I had to put up a different person than I wasn't.
Yeah.
And it sucked because, you know, I didn't feel comfortable. You know, I didn't feel like that. I feel like a hypocrite. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Like, I personally did, you know, but it's so true, man. Like,
yeah.
You just like hit a little sensitive nerve
right in the feels.
Yeah.
Right in the feels.
Well, and you know, that's kind of, I mean, not to keep you guys too much longer, cause I know y'all got families too, but, that's kind of why, I stepped back from doing praise and worship at the time was because I realized it not by any fault of the folks who were leading the worship teams or anything like that, but it was I had a certain amount of bitterness growing within me because it was the only place where I had at the time to sort of live and grow and breathe musically. But because of the constraints of, you know, and some of them are legit, so I'm not trying to trash worship music in church. It has its place. But because as a musician, I was struggling with needing more of a challenge artistically, if you will. I realized that I was getting bitter about this area of my life. And I was like, this isn't healthy. Like, and it became the sort of thing where for the sake of my own heart and my attitude about church and worship in general, I just had to take a step back. And I think it's okay to do that. I mean, I certainly hope it's okay because it's what I did.
Definitely, man. I think I had a couple of those times as well, man.
Yeah.
I had to take breaks. Yeah. I couldn't. You know what I mean?
And yeah.
I totally understand.
And it was, you know, to the credit, again, of the folks who I played with and the leaders of our community, that they gave me the freedom to do that. Like, I stepped back with their blessing, if that makes sense. So yeah. It was not the sort of thing where it was like there was any bad blood. I just communicated with them. I was like, hey, I need some time to figure out who I am as a musician apart from just this and what it is that I hopefully can contribute in other ways. And so, yeah, man, I'd love to see a day, and I don't know what it would look like now, but I would love to see a day where there's space for more contemplative music and or time for contemplation within a service and or time for lament, you know, within the liturgy of the church. And you know what, I know there have to be examples. I'm just, you know, my experience is probably maybe too narrow to know of places that are doing it in a healthy manner and are doing it well. But I think there has to be space. I mean, cause that's the human experience, and that's the human experience through walking with the Lord as well. I mean, you know, not to get overly cliched, but I mean, if Jesus wept over the loss of a friend and took time for that, then there's got to be time for us to do that as well. There's got to be time for us to grieve corporately over injustice and to mourn, you know, the loss of life, and to just for the full range of those experiences. If we can't walk through those, both individually and corporately, then I think that there's something in our theology and in our art and our approach to art that needs to be examined. So.
I don't think there's any more that we can say after that. That's seriously beautiful. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Thank you for this, and we'll see you on Sunday at church. All right, man. Thank you.
Take care,
good
Jeremy.
Night. Good night. Bye. Good night.